Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For your listening information this afternoon at 12:20, we'll be bringing you NPR News special coverage of President Obama's news conference, which should be very interesting. So you're invited to tune us in for, well, you're already here. Just stay with us for in-depth coverage and analysis. NPR News special coverage of President Obama's news conference, the first since March, I think. It's at 12:20 this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. The National Geographic cover story is Cuba, or Cuba, on the Edge of Change, authored by Cynthia Gorney, who is our guest this hour. 4 years after Fidel Castro formally handed Cuba's presidency to his younger brother Raul, the country gradually shedding the ascetic nationalism of the revolution and becoming more open, flexible, and entrepreneurial. But there are substantial problems. Cynthia spent 9 weeks over the course of 2 years traveling and interviewing the optimists, many who are experimenting with new business ideas, and the pessimists who are making plans to flee the island in pursuit of opportunities abroad. Cynthia is a professor in the Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and National Geographic, and we're very pleased to have her with us. Let me give you all that, how you can join us, information. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org, post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook, or tweet at K Dunn Show. Hello, Cynthia. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. Very nice to be with you.
Why don't you start with the story? It's a compelling one of Eduardo. You start with him, and he is one of those people who tried to leave the island, you know, at great risk, and it's a scary story in many ways, but he typifies some of the discontent.
Well, the fellow I call Eduardo in the story, that is not his real name, because there is still considerable liability for anybody who criticizes publicly, and the emphasis is on publicly, the Cuban government and situation right now. I found people enormously willing to complain privately behind any sort of closed door. I want to stress, I didn't go to Cuba looking for, quote, dissidents, unquote, or
no,
for dissatisfied people. It was my mandate from the Geographic was wonderfully open. It was go to Cuba. Things are happening there. We don't know what. Just hang out and listen to whatever you can hear. And I met the guy called Eduardo on my second trip there. I made three separate trips to Cuba. And we were on a long drive, and he just started talking, as I found Cubans very inclined to do. They're, I always hesitate to make national generalizations about a country, but Cubans love to talk. They are a wonderfully well-educated people, by and large. That was one of the unmitigated successes of the revolution, was widely educating the populace. And Eduardo was a working-class young man who had worked in a couple of factories. He'd worked in a big transportation industry for a while. But he was about in his mid-30s when I met him. And he had been interested in getting out for a long time, not a political dissident, doesn't care about politics. A lot of the Cubans that you talk to on the island will tell you that the people best known for being political complainers, as they will call them, outside of Cuba, are just that, complainers. They don't really seem to have an alternate program. They don't get nearly as much respect inside Cuba as they do outside. What you hear much more of in Cuba is what I heard from Eduardo, which is a litany of complaints that are all based in, I love my country and I wish I could stay here, but.
Right.
And so as we were about 2 hours into this conversation, he suddenly turned to me. I am a Spanish speaker. I have Mexican family, and so I'm fluent in the language. And so it was easy for me to converse. And he turned to me, and he suddenly said, okay, look, I got to tell you something. And I said, what? He said, we're building a boat. Eight of my buddies and I are building a boat, and we're going to try again to get out of here. And so we then just developed this friendship over coming weeks, in which he had the sense that he could trust me not to go to the government or something with this. And we talked a lot about why he was so intent on leaving. He was going to be leaving a wife and a child behind. He intended to send them money. The act of leaving without a government visa permit. There's an exit visa. It's called the tarjeta blanca, the white card, in Cuba. And one of the things that makes people furious in Cuba, most people, is that the government has to give you permission to leave the country. So Eduardo did not have a tarjeta blanca. And what he was going to be doing would be a violation of Cuban law. So that's one of the themes that stayed in my mind the whole time that I was there. And the reason that I told his story was not just that it was interesting, obviously, and that I was personally caught up in the drama of whether he would leave. It was that the nature of Eduardo's complaints, the things that he was frustrated about, that was what I heard all over the island from people of multiple classes, multiple positions, different kinds of professions, this general level of combined love for the country, love for the Cuban people, some sense of great admiration varying from modest to enormous for the benefits that the revolution had brought them, and a consuming sense of rage and frustration at the nature of the generals, the government, and the economic problems that were making it impossible for people to advance on their own.
More on his story as we progress here. One of the themes that seems to run through the article is how difficult it is for people to make a living, that you've got people educated as doctors who have to moonlight as cab drivers because they can make more money driving a cab than they can in their medical profession. Why is that?
Well, one of the quickest ways to start a long and engaging conversation in Cuba is to turn to a Cuban and say, I don't understand your economy. And the Cuban will burst out laughing and say, of course you don't. Nobody understands our economy. And then, assuming that there's no government minders around to listen, in other words, you're inside a car or inside someone's house or something, you don't then have to ask any questions for the next half hour. The Cuban will just talk and talk and talk about how complex and difficult things are. I'm going to see if I can summarize this enormously complicated thing for people who are not, as I was not, familiar with the sequence of Cuban events that led to the weird economic situation they're in right now. The revolution comes in 1959, and regardless of what you think about Fidel and the nature of the revolution, one of the things that it did, without question, was widely educate, as I mentioned earlier, a populace that previously had lived very much stratified in the classic old-fashioned Latin American manner, where the poor had no access to education and so on. They created a highly educated society in which it is, in fact, true that for many, many years, a young boy or girl from the countryside could aspire to be a physician. They had one of the world's best-known medical corps. Lots of people receiving graduate degrees free of charge, because free education and free health care were two of the basic tenets that the revolution was supposed to provide. So they have this enormously educated workforce. They're held up for many years by the USSR, which likes the fact that Cuba is a working communist country and is totally subsidizing the country by paying very inflated prices on their sugar and so on. USSR collapses. Suddenly, the entire Cuban economy, which has been sort of going along with all these educated people sending their doctors and so on, falls apart. This is in the early 1990s. They enter a period of tremendous dark depression, which, if you look at what actually happens, makes our depression look a little bit like playtime. People literally starving in the countryside, long, long blackout periods, no fuel, and so on. How do they get out of this depression? They don't actually produce anything, as it turns out. Their sugar industry is lousy. They can't sell sugar to the United States because there's been a long-standing American embargo.
Yes.
The things they produce in factories suffer from all of the classic problems of a planned socialist economy. The factories are grossly inefficient. The stuff that they make is lousy quality. They're not exporting anything. Mm-hmm. What do they have? They have an educated populace, they have beaches, and they have the potential infrastructure for a tourist economy. So despite the fact that they are a famous working island of socialism and communism, they throw open the island to tourism rather aggressively in the 1990s. They build all these fancy tourist facilities and so on, and in doing so, invite people from around the world, including Americans who are perfectly happy to defy the embargo and go through Mexico or Canada, to come and enjoy their tourist facilities. Money from all different countries of the world starts coming in, and it totally, there's always been a black market going in Cuba, but suddenly there are multiple currencies running around the island because of what they have decided is going to be their main product, which is tourism and nice people, right? So in order to try to bring some control to all the money that's floating around the island, they basically invent a new currency. They call it the Cuban convertible peso, shortened to the CUC, C-U-C, the peso convertible, they call it in Spanish. And so, but they still have a national currency going at the same time. So this is very important. It's very difficult for an American to get a head around this because it's so unlike anything we do. But the situation in Cuba right now is that there are two separate currencies running around simultaneously. One is the peso convertible, which is it looks exactly like the other currency. It has bills and coins and so on. And it's perfectly legal. It's perfectly above board. Someone like me goes to Cuba with my dollars or my euros or my Canadian dollars or whatever. I go to a bank. I convert it into this money. And this money has a roughly one-to-one equivalency with the American dollar. However, at the same time, all the Cubans are getting paid by the Cuban government in the national peso, the peso nacional, which is worth 1/25 of one of these convertible pesos. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the crazy situation in Cuba right now is that if you are a physician, you are very well trained, you genuinely know how to perform, you know, gastrointestinal surgery and so on, but your paid salary from the Cuban government is coming in pesos nacionales. So you're being paid in a currency that doesn't buy you any of the things that you want because, hold on, here's the other tricky part. Although your basic foodstuffs, your bus fare, your books, your movie entrance, certain aspects of daily life can be purchased in this national peso, the currency in which you are paid, all the other stuff that you want to live what we would call a sort of professional's life, deodorant, packaged foods, a car, gasoline, a cell phone, which almost all Cubans now try to have, access to the internet, which is legally available to Cubans but horrifically expensive. That's one of the ways that the Cuban government keeps Cubans from getting access to the internet. All these things must be paid for in the other currency, the convertible peso, the CUC. The only way you can get that other currency is to have some relation with the foreign world. That either means you have relatives sending you the money from the outside, or it means you have a job in which you have daily contact with tourists who pay you in the money they're carrying, which is the convertible pesos, the CUCs. That's why I end up meeting, for example, among many, many other people in a similar circumstance, an emergency room driver who makes 20 times his medical salary on the 3 days a week that he drives his old beater Russian car that he inherited from his father carrying passengers around. Mm-hmm. And this makes this situation, which everybody in Cuba knows about, no one denies that it exists, not even the most ardent of the government propagandists, makes people crazy because it demeans the education that people have justifiably worked so hard to get and are so proud of. They can't live the kind of life that they want to live. You hear over and over and over again Cubans complaining about physicians having to go to work on their bicycles because they can't afford a car. Physicians getting paid a little extra. It's still not considered proper to bribe your physician with cash, although I'm sure it happens. But it's quite proper to bring your physician a pig or some liquor or some produce from your garden as a way of augmenting what you know will be his or her terrible salary.
So what is
the last thing. The Cubans refer to this as the inverted pyramid. The more education you have, the likelier it is that you're not going to be able to use that education to actually support your family and make any kind of a decent living.
Understandably, that would make people very unhappy. So what is the government doing to address those very heartfelt, serious concerns?
Well, the answer to that question really depends on who you talk to in Cuba. What a lot of Cubans on the street will say is not very much. Here's what has happened in the last 2 years in Cuba, which nominally is a very significant change. the government, the vocabulary is very careful and very delicate, since Cuba still refers to itself in all kinds of publications and formal documents as a socialist republic. You will see, anybody who travels in Cuba will immediately see, you know, Viva el socialismo, long live socialism, socialismo o muerte, socialism or death, you'll see on the walls and so on. So there's been no change in the vocabulary about what kind of economy Cuba is. At the same time, however, the government made legal slightly over 180 categories of what in Spanish is called cuenta propismo, which literally translates to the keeping of one's own account. And what that means is you may legally and openly engage in certain kinds of private enterprise now in Cuba that were not legal in previous years. They were always done because, as I mentioned earlier, Cuba has a thriving black market, but it wasn't okay to do it openly. Now, if you walk around Cuba, you'll see people selling items on the street, selling shoes, selling sandwiches, selling clothes, selling DVDs. You can engage in the private work of plumbing and house repair and so on. It is legal now to buy and sell real estate property as well as to buy and sell cars within certain limits. These are expressions of private enterprise that were prohibited by under the theory that everything was provided for by the government as early as 5 years ago. So this is new. And what the government apologists now will say to you is this shows that we are engaging in private enterprise and we are making pathways for people who are so frustrated to make money legitimately. What the cynics will tell you, though, is that the government is continuing to keep so many controls on these areas of private enterprise that it's very, very difficult for anybody to make anything of themselves, really. And regardless of where you... I'm not going to pretend that I know the truth of what's happening in Cuba over the next 2 years, by no means. It's an enormously complex place. But it is clear that the country is engaged in a really fascinating grapple right now with what it imagines it will become 2 to 3 to 5 years from now. Because there's still a lot of very public discussion about the idea that it's not, that what they want, what model they're looking for, it's definitely not the U.S. They look at the U.S. and they see a country of tremendous wealth that has no health care system, no national health care system, that does not offer its people a free education. One of the things that the very, very bad and grossly censored public news venues on television and in the newspapers will show constantly is every negative aspect of life in the United States. Violence, Occupy was very popular when it was being covered in Cuba, the Occupy movement. They'll show homelessness and so on. All accurate aspects of life in the U.S., to be sure, if somewhat one-sided. So we are not the model for them, for sure, nor is China with its environmental havoc and its sudden embrace of people getting very wealthy, nor is Europe, which is a mess, nor is Mexico, which is caught in the narco wars right now. So they are in a fascinating struggle right now with what they actually want to become as an economy. And there are voices in the island saying, if we're going to bring in private enterprise, we really ought to bring it in so that people are allowed to make money and grow and develop both personal wealth and job opportunities for other people. There are others in the country, equally powerful right now, saying that's not what we want. The development of private wealth is the very thing that we fought the revolution to overcome. Mm-hmm. We don't think it's okay for some of our citizens to be thousands of times wealthier than other citizens. And we have to find a path that will allow us some room for individual expression without going to the Sam Walton model, because we don't like that. That's not what we want for our country. And I have to say that the combination of all of these things, these enormously profound questions, a place that is physically beautiful, and a people who love to talk, are very well educated, are very friendly and open, makes Cuba right now one of the most fascinating places I have been in many, many years. I loved my time there.
Cynthia Gorney is our guest this hour. She has a cover story article on Cuba, this month's issue, Cuba on the Edge of Change. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. She's a professor at the Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. She also worked at the Washington Post for a number of years as an award-winning national features writer, South American bureau chief, and the first writer for the Post style section based on the West Coast. She's the author of a number of books, and it's a fascinating piece that she spent over 2 months over a period of a couple of years in Cuba, listening to people, talking with people, and analyzing all that's going on that fascinating island. So let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a message on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And that's it. Twitter, if you want to use that. That's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. President Obama is having a news conference. It's at 12:20, and we will be bringing you NPR News special coverage of his news conference, his first in 8 months, and we invite you to join us. You can listen here on the Ideas Network, or you can always go online at WPR.org. Phones are filled right now. Use our email if you'd like to get through, talk@WPR.org. Jerry in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Kathleen. Once again, a great show. Hello?
Hi, Jerry. Thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah. I have a question, and that's regarding the racial situation in Cuba. Is there a problem with housing or jobs or professions or even politicians down there with people different persuasions racially?
Jerry, that's a really interesting question. The Cuban official line answer to that is no. That's one of the things that we took care of in the revolution. We took care of racial discrimination as well as gender discrimination. There's no question that the revolution made life much better for the darkest skinned people of Cuba, which, as you suggest, has a wide, wide variety of colors going on. And there's a lot of intermarriage. And so Cubans, like Brazilians, will run the range from very light skin to very dark skin because, of course, there was a lot of African, there were many Africans who came there during the slavery period, during the colonial times. In practice, though, when you look at the highest level families, those have achieved success within the military and also by making money in various either legal or illegitimate ways, they tend to be really light-skinned. And the people who are out in the countryside tend still to be really dark-skinned. So I think the answer that most Cubans would give you is things are a lot better now. It is certainly possible in a way that it never was 50 or 60 years ago for a black Cuban from the countryside to go to university and get an advanced degree. But at the same time, the people in power look very much as they did 50 and 60 years ago. The modes of discrimination are not overt, but they are definitely still there.
Well, I find it interesting, you know, that about that, you know, and I went there about 5 years ago via Jamaica, but I didn't spend as much time out as you did, a few days, but I found that I experienced that to be true.
Yeah, Cuba, like most countries, like ours, is filled with contradictions, filled with things that are said in political rhetoric that are not carried out necessarily in practice. It's just that in Cuba, it hits you in the face a little bit more because the place is so permeated with revolutionary slogans about equality and opportunity for everybody. And at the same time, the levels of poverty and frustration are so great and so ever-present when you're in the streets. And, of course, it's only 11 million people, so all of these issues are quite concentrated.
I wonder if this is representative of the values of a number of the people. You talk about the signs you mentioned in your piece, Jose Lopez, who immigrated back to Cuba after 6 years in Florida. You write that he had a growing disenchantment with the values of some of his hyper-acquisitive Cuban neighbors in Miami. Is there a shared value system, would you say, that most people believe that there's too much, some people have way too much, and we need to have distributed the wealth?
Kathleen, that is such an interesting question, and it was one of the things that I talked about most with Cubans. And I would say that among those people who are there now, in other words, they were not part of the first generation of exiles who either felt themselves forced to leave or couldn't stand what they saw happening in the early years of the revolution. They were not part of the subsequent waves of migration, which were really people looking for economic opportunity, typically more than some kind of freedom of political expression. People who are there now, whenever we would get to the part of the conversation where I would say, okay, so you're really ticked off about this, 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 and this. This doesn't work. What do you want? What do you see? What does the word socialism mean to you? And then almost universally, I cannot tell you how many dozens of times I had the same conversation. People would say, first of all, I don't know what the word socialism means. It gets thrown around here so much that it doesn't actually mean very much to me. But what they would also say is, what I envision as a fair society is one in which people are allowed to work for themselves. They are allowed to accumulate for themselves, but not that much. They would say, I mean, if you talk to people in Cuba, they would say, yeah, businesses should be regulated. Yes, workers should be protected so that they make a decent wage. No, it isn't okay for a business owner to pay workers poorly and garner enormous profits. There is a And whenever, as I mentioned earlier in the program, one of the fascinating things about Cuba is that over and over again, I heard people say that they really had no specific model of a country that they thought worked well. They saw problems in all kinds of different economic setups, including China. And certainly, I mean, don't even start talking about Russia. Everybody would roll their eyes and say that's an example of what we don't want to do as we exit from socialism, if that's what we're going to do. A country run by corruption and oligarchs is how they think of Russia, and forget it. But occasionally I would hear people speak vaguely of the social democracies of Northern Europe, Scandinavia. But even then, it's like, okay, we understand that that's a completely different place than what we have here. And so they are really grappling. But your central question about whether they have a certain set of shared values, I think it's fair to say that they do. They truly believe that a national health care system is a people's right. The famous healthcare system in Cuba right now is having awful infrastructure problems, and although people are proud of it in theory, in practice they will roll their eyes and tell you, man, if you get sick, you better be sure that your relatives bring clean towels and Lysol to the hospital because the place is a wreck. So that's a problem, but they are proud of the fact and will say over and over again, yeah, it is still the case that a poor person from the countryside can go to medical school. Now, when he gets out of medical school, he's going to be driving a cab in order to make a living. But he can go to medical school, and that's important. And we don't think that in your country it's really very likely that a poor kid from the ghetto or from the countryside is going to be able to go all the way through medical school at the people's expense.
Right.
So you're not what we're after.
Let's go to Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Kathleen. I spent 12 days bicycling in Cuba this past March, and I think I'm probably going to echo your guest's comments here, but I experienced four economies. They had the kook, the peso, the black market, and then they have a public-private economy. And I also had the benefit of staying in government-sponsored housing and then private housing when we were out in the countryside, which was fascinating. So seeing both the city and country, I experienced, I think, two different worlds. And what is fascinating for me is, as your guest alluded to, is what are they going to become? And when I was there, I wondered, would they become Sweden or some model like that? Because clearly they don't want to become the U.S., and that is fine. And finally, I think the comment about the person who goes to medical school and ends up driving a cab is so true. I did some calculations while I was there, and when we stayed at that private house, the tip I left, which was not a large tip, but the tip I left was the equivalent of, and that was for 2 days, was the equivalent of a half a month's salary for the Ooh. Household that I stayed in.
So, this you get this
Thanks,
experience,
Michael.
Yeah. You get this experience over and over there, and it is very sobering and distressing for Americans or Europeans who, once you start figuring out the calculus of these dual salaries, I had his experience again and again, where I would either leave a tip or I would deliberately take a cab. that I knew was going to cost 30 times what taking a bus with a peso coin would cost, simply because I knew that I was probably putting a month's salary into the pocket of somebody who was an engineer or a child psychologist and needed that money to feed his or her family that week.
Thank you very much, Michael, for your call. We go to Lisa next in Madison. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. My husband was actually born in Cuba, and he was a first-generation exile.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to find out if it would be a time for him to return as a visitor, because he's not been able to return because of just family issues and fear that he's going to be, you know.
Oh, absolutely. No, this is really, what's your name?
Lisa?
Caller?
Lisa.
Oh, Lisa. Yeah. Lisa, I'll tell you, one of the most dramatic scenes that I experienced over, I was back and forth three times and for other reasons in and out of the Havana airport more times than that. And one of the first things that knocks you out in Cuba is you'll be standing at the Havana airport, whatever, waiting for your ride or your luggage or something. And what you see is, it's an old-fashioned airport. It's kind of like a 1960s. Reminds me actually of the Duluth, Minnesota airport. My mother was from your part of the country. And you're standing in the waiting area, and here's a group of people waiting anxiously, looking at the gate that people are going to walk out of. And there's five or six or seven relatives and little kids and so on. And somebody appears in the doorway, walking out of the plane, and everybody starts sobbing. Everybody bursts into tears, and there is embracing and people falling to their knees and crossing themselves and the most intense hugging you've ever seen. I saw this scene like a dozen times. I thought you could do a fantastic documentary about Cuba just standing at that gate, because these family reunions are happening over and over again. And I don't know, Lisa, whether you saw, there was quite a moving piece that appeared. It was an editorial that appeared in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago, written by somebody who sounds like a family situation quite like yours. It was a youngish woman. She sounded like she was in her 30s, 30s to 40s. And she was the daughter of a Cuban exile. I can't remember whether she had ever actually been in Cuba, but she finally decided, I got to go back. I got to go back and see family. I'm going to do this. And she and her family had to contrive to lie to her Cuban dad about the fact that they were going back, because they were so convinced that he would become apoplectic. He'd, like, take to his bed and be furious.
Oh.
And so they said, we're going to visit so-and-so. We're going to go have some time and whatever. And we're going to have a little vacation time. And finally, once she was gone, somebody told him. And he was okay with it. When they got back, he said, tell me about the so-and-so, Aunt so-and-so. You know, tell me about the cousins. Tell me what you saw.
Yeah.
So these visits are now welcomed by the Cubans, I have to say, because they know that the relatives are bringing in money and goods with them. It's one of the things that's holding up the Cuban economy. And they are, had there been a change of administration, the policy probably would have changed again. But the Obama administration has made these visits much easier. There's back and forth negotiation with the most hard line of the anti-Castro community in Florida about how much you can bring in and how frequently you can go. But, oh my gosh, your husband should go. He should go, and he should visit the relatives, and he should go around the countryside. Absolutely.
All right. Are you on your way, Lisa?
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. You mentioned in the article how much money is sent to the island, $2 billion. It's really important for these visits to take place and for relatives to send money to keep things going, right?
Oh, it's one of the principal supports right now for the Cuban economy are money coming in from the outside, either sent in by banknote. There's a very above board regulated now system by which people who live in the United States, Europe, or Mexico send money by draft and so on every month. And you'll see the lines outside the banks in Cuba as people go to get their money. Or they bring it in legitimately or illegitimately. They bring in cash. On one of my visits, a friend of mine who had grown up in Cuba, left as a teenager, said, please carry these $200 bills to my friend so-and-so in Havana. And I did that. Just to hand him, he was living in squalor in a little apartment in the city. They will also bring in, I have a friend in my area who's not himself Cuban, but for a variety of reasons has become sort of semi-Cuban. He's actually Mexican. But whenever he goes back, he brings suitcases full of stuff, shoes, clothing, and so on. And then he gives that to his friends who are there, and they sell it 4 convertible pesos, which makes them a lot of money comparatively and allows them to sustain themselves. So that plus the tourist money that is being brought in by visitors coming in by cruise ship and by airplane load and so on are two of the primary things right now holding up the Cuban economy. The others are nickel, to a certain modest extent sugar, and they're very much hoping that they're going to have success in finding pumpable and usable oil, although so far that has been a big disappointment. They know they have a lot of offshore oil, but the quality is poor and it's difficult to get to. And so far, repeated exploratory perforations of the oil bed outside Cuba have not yielded very much. So they all have their fingers crossed for that because they'd love to be a net oil exporter, but they still are very much dependent on Venezuelan oil in order to support the economy. That's one of the other great big arms of the Cuban economy is they export professionals, mostly doctors, but also teachers and trainers, and in particular to Venezuela. And the re-election of Hugo Chavez as president of Venezuela was an enormous relief for Cuba because Hugo Chavez had always been a great friend of the Castros, brothers in socialism and so on. Mm-hmm. And they have a kind of equivalent, a smaller equivalent of the old Soviet holding up of Cuba model, under which Venezuela sends Cuba an enormous amount of greatly subsidized oil. Cuba uses a lot of it and actually exports some of it for its own economy. And in return, Cuba sends Venezuela thousands of professionals who work as its physicians, as its medical professionals, as its sports trainers, and as its teachers.
Cynthia Gorney is our guest. Her cover story, this month's issue of National Geographic, Cuba on the Edge of Change. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have a couple lines open for you. Right now, you can always send a message via our email, which is talk@wpr.org. Messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or Twitter @KDunnShow. President Obama is having a news conference this afternoon. It's the first since March, 8 months now since he's had... Is that 8 months? Almost. Yeah, I guess it is. That's amazing. It's his first news conference in all those months. His administration, of course, looking at this fiscal cliff and sex scandal, not his administration, but General Petraeus. I'm sure he will be asked about that at this press conference. So you're invited to join us for in-depth coverage and analysis. It starts at 12:20. This afternoon. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Art in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Art.
Hi. So I agree with your guest entirely that Cuba is a fascinating place and full of contradictions. But I think that perhaps she and many other U.S. people who visited Cuba do not fully appreciate the impact of U.S. policy. I mean, just as you may know, I've been to Cuba over 10 times. I head the Cuba subcommittee of the National Lawyers Guild. So just yesterday, there was another UN vote, 21 years in a row. Virtually all nations voted to condemn U.S. policy of economic interference with Cuba and hostility, including violation of international law and trying to prevent other countries from trading with Cuba. And the Cuban foreign minister spoke, and he said, perhaps now is an opportunity for President Obama to change 50 years of failed U.S. policy, which I think would be a good idea. So there's many areas to touch on. I'll just start with one, which is immigration, the story of Eduardo. So Eduardo, assuming that he, when he gets in his raft or watercraft, tries to go to the U.S., would not only be violating Cuban law, he would be violating U.S. law. And U.S. law, and I've got the law in front of me, Helms-Burton law from 1996, states that it is an act, quoted, this is a quote, an act of aggression, end quote, for Cuba to allow unlimited immigration to the U.S., for which the president is already authorized to take all means, which would mean act of war if necessary. Cuba does not, they have their, you know, they've obviously just modified, announced modification of their policy for people leaving the country, and if they would be taking a raft to Mexico, which is not very likely, that would be a different story. But when Cuba has allowed large numbers of people unregulated to leave to the U.S. beyond the very restricted U.S. lottery system, which I think is 10,000 people a year, negotiated with Cuba, arguing for a larger number, U.S. arguing for a smaller number. But that's the legal way to go, legal by U.S. law and by Cuban law. If Cuba allows people to go illegally to the U.S., we have threatened Cuba with war over this issue, and the law already recognizes that that's an act of aggression by Cuba. That's just one example. Internet is another example. Discrimination issues is probably another example.
Cynthia, your response.
Art, first of all, thank you very much. There is no question in my mind, nor the minds of almost every single person I talk to, and let me qualify that, every person I talk to who is not paid to say otherwise, that the U.S. policy toward Cuba is widely regarded as a failure. There's no question. And one of the things that you hear that is the most interesting inside Cuba is that although the embargo, as it's referred to in Cuba, which is, as listeners probably know, U.S. longstanding U.S. law since the revolution prevents us from trading with Cuba, it prevents tourism with Cuba, and so on. People will say over and over in Cuba, the embargo is absurd, it's counterproductive, it's punitive, it makes no sense, all of which I have to say I personally agree with. What they will also say with a little rolling of the eyes is Cubans will blame the embargo for every single thing, every poor decision they make, everything that goes wrong in Cuba. My favorite line was somebody saying a cockroach drops from the ceiling into your coffee cup and the government will blame it on the embargo.
Mm-hmm.
I think that within Cuba, there's a very strong understanding of the effects that the embargo has had, while at the same time a lot of cynicism about how much blame has been placed on it. With regard to a couple things about the Internet, and then I want to talk about the Eduardo situation. The Internet is a very interesting situation in Cuba right now. It is legally, theoretically, accessible to all Cubans, except that it's not. And what that means is there are a number of places where, even though this is supposedly not the policy, outside Havana, I would walk into the equivalent of internet cafes, which are the public phone company centers where people pay their cell phone bills and are there are internet terminals set up, and there would be signs there saying, if you do not have a foreign passport, you cannot use these terminals. And at one point, I actually got into an argument with the lady sitting behind the counter. This was in one of the cities in the countryside, and said, so if I walk in here, I can get on the internet, but if my Cuban friend walks in here and has enough money to pay the hourly fee, that my Cuban friend cannot use the internet. And she gave me the look that I had come to know and cherish and hate simultaneously in Cuba, which was the facial expression that said, this makes no sense. It's not
right.
My fault. This was passed down from up above. Mm-hmm. She said, no está autorizado. It's not authorized. I'm sorry. She gives me this shrug. Like, I know this is really bad. And Cubans in general are furious about not having access to the internet. They regard it as a way, there's a whole government argument. The government arguments about lack of access to the internet go like this. Number one, it's not because we're really trying to cut people off. It's because the lack of access to American technology has made it impossible for us to set up the infrastructure. I will say right now, nobody in Cuba believes that. There is supposedly a fiber optic cable going from Venezuela to Cuba that was supposed to be put into place last summer. Absolute silence clamped down from the Cuban government on where it is and what's happened to it. I've heard from people that there was some kind of a corruption problem or that somebody was bought off, the technology wasn't right. At any rate, the point is that within Cuba, everybody you talk to without exception believes that the reason the Cuban government controls access to the internet is that they don't want Cubans getting a full look at everything that's out there on the internet.
Mm.
Art is quite right in what he in him saying that if Eduardo had succeeded, and I think I'll be mean to your listeners and tell them that I'm not going to say how Eduardo's journey came out. They have
You're
to
not
look on the National Geographic and look at it.
Cynthia,
it's online. It's
okay.
Online, Kathleen. They
okay.
can get to it.
All right.
Were it the case that he had succeeded in his journey. He's right. It would have been illegal on both ends. He would have been an illegal immigrant in the United States. he did not have when, and I'm, as I make it clear in the article, when he and his cohorts were planning their departure, they neither sought the tarjeta blanca, the card that would have given the, that would have made their departure legal as far as the Cubans were concerned, nor the U.S. entry visa, which would have cost $160 U.S. money, convertible kooks, money that was just completely unimaginable for his kind of salary, and probably entailed a year and a half long wait, and he probably would have been denied it because he doesn't have specific friends or relatives in the United States sending for him. So I think my ultimate point to Art is I agree with him. The U.S. policy toward Cuba has certainly been a part of the difficulties that the country is undergoing right now. But when you spend time in Cuba talking to regular Cubans, what you hear is not as big a part of what's screwed up about Cuba right now as those who have been traditional Cuba lovers in the United States might want to believe.
Adam sends a tweet. Cynthia, can U.S. citizens work in Cuba and or volunteer there?
As U.S. citizens,
yes.
It really depends. You can go, right now, U.S. citizens can go in a legal manner on State Department authorized trips that are for cultural exchange. I believe that as far as U.S.'s policy is concerned, there is not a way that you can volunteer there, although if you're with a church group or something, these definitions are very vague. I remember my father, who is a physician, went to Cuba to do some plastic surgery work with an organization about 3 years ago. And he was told by the State Department exactly what he could and could not do. And one of the things he was not allowed to do legally was to teach. His reaction to that was, come and get me, coppers. And he taught when he was in the, he taught everybody that he could when he was in the, when he was in the operating rooms there. So it's, as Art mentioned earlier, our policy toward what we can and cannot do in Cuba is irrational and counterproductive, and it is worth anybody figuring out exactly, rule by rule, what's okay and what's not, so that they can then make their decisions about which U.S. laws they're going to comply with.
You included a light bulb story, which I'd like for you to tell. Good idea, bad execution.
This is a woman that I spoke to who is a well-educated woman, has chosen to stay in Cuba, enjoys her life there, is very frustrated by it, and was very thoughtful in talking to me about the way that Cuba has gone about good ideas wrongly, in her view, over and over again. And this particular story was about, we were just standing in her house in Havana, quite a pleasant home. And she nodded toward the light bulbs and she said they're all fluorescent because in a national energy saving and environmental saving campaign, the government made us change all our light bulbs a few years ago. She said they would come out to your house, they would take out your old light bulb and they would smash them in front of your face on the floor just to make sure that you weren't sneaking in any of your old light bulbs. And her line to me, which I used in this story, was the idea was wonderful, changing all the light bulbs. The problem was how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of the Cubans who are there, there are people, I want to stress, there are people in Cuba who are very deep supporters of what is referred to in Spanish throughout the island universally as el triunfo de la revolución, the triumph of the revolution. The problem they're having now is what happens on a day-to-day basis with people who are trying to live grown-up lives and take care of their families within the context of that revolutionary triumph. It's not working out very well for them right now.
Yeah. One more call, if you can do it in a minute, Randy. Hi. Quickly,
good
please.
After. Good morning. I've had the opportunity to travel Cuba three times, last time being about a year ago about this time, and all agriculture trips. And I just wanted to comment that their agriculture, by our standards, is very backward, but they're moving forward. They're producing a lot of good food. They're more economically friendly to their land than we are here. We don't raise all corn and beans, and I'm a grain farmer, by the way. But I do what I have to do to make a living. So their agriculture is actually doing better than ours. They've increased production tremendously. You talked about when the Soviet Union went out, they call it the special period. They put in a tremendous amount of urban gardens. In 10 years,
hold
they
it.
Went from importing most all their food to importing like 10%.
We have about 15 seconds, Cynthia.
The answer is yes, lots of organic stuff, lots of urban gardens. They're still importing the vast majority of their food, unfortunately, and that's one of the things they're working on.
Mm. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a wonderful article and a good hour. Thanks. Our guest this hour is Cynthia Gorney. She is a professor of journalism in the graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and National Geographic. And as she told us, if you want to know the ending of the story of Eduardo, you can go to the magazine online, but you may miss some of the gorgeous pictures, which you can only really look at via the magazine. It's Cuba on the Edge of Change, the cover story of this month's magazine. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. A reminder, the president having his first news conference since March, and we will be carrying it here on the Ideas Network at 12:20. Thank you for listening. Great conversation ahead. Till tomorrow.